Welcome to the Modern Federalist. Your compass in the world of politics, policy, and people. We're here to challenge norms, question narratives, and offer balanced insight on pressing issues. Your host, Charlton Allen, is a seasoned analyst and a staunch advocate for freedom. With his sharp intellect, he'll guide you through the maze of contemporary politics. Whether you're a political enthusiast or just a curious observer, you've found your haven. This is the Modern Federalist. Welcome to the revolution.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 12 of the Modern Federalist Podcast, where we dissect the pressing issues of our time through the lens of liberty. I'm Charlton Allen, your host, and today's episode promises to be a roller coaster ride through the corridors of power, the quirkiness of academia, and the resilience of our shared constitutional values. Let's dive right in. First on tap is the California Energy Circus. We shine a spotlight on the Golden State's energy debacle with none other than Governor Gavin Newsom as the ringleader. His ambitious green energy goals have turned into a high wire act, leaving Californians grappling with soaring electricity costs and a grid that flickers like a faulty bulb. Is it a circus or a catastrophe? We'll dissect the truth. Next on tap, buckle up as we explore the latest woke escapades at the UCLA Geffen School of Medicine. It's a wild ride through the halls of academia. Are the nation's future doctors being trained or indoctrinated? You be the judge. Next on the agenda, we unravel the pro-Hamas protests at Columbia University. The chants echo from Morningside Heights to Main Street, USA. It's a disturbing trend spreading like wildfire across our nation's campuses. What's driving these misguided voices, and what does it mean for America's future? Then, I have an interview with our special guest, Jameson Brogy, who joins us to discuss the North Carolina Reach Act, a bold proposal aimed at fortifying constitutional governance and civics education in North Carolina's public universities. Strangely, it faces considerable opposition. Why? We dig deep into the heart of the matter. Part one of this important interview is in this episode. Then I will wrap things up in an episode coda. This is the Modern Federalist Podcast, where we stand unwaveringly for truth, liberty, and American exceptionalism. Our commitment to fostering informed citizens and preserving our constitutional heritage burns brighter than ever. The light of liberty shines before us. Let's go. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Modern Federalist Podcast, where we dissect the quirks and quagmires of politics with a dash of wit and a sprinkle of skepticism. After all, laughter is the best renewable resource. I'm your host, Charlton Allen, and today we're plunging like an over-caffeinated dolphin into the California Energy Circus, a spectacle that's part comedy, part tragedy, and entirely bewildering. After reviewing a recent commentary by Miles Pollard and Hope Candless, which is linked in the episode notes, I crafted this segment. Their commentary sheds light on California Governor Gavin Newsom's energy experiment and its impact on the state's residents. Takeaway number one, California's climate policies are like a kale smoothie, healthy in theory, but nobody really enjoys it. The Golden State has been flexing its environmental muscles, but let's face it, flexing doesn't pay the bills. And speaking of bills, California's energy experiment has gone awry faster than a squirrel on an espresso bench. But here's the twist. This electricity cost extravaganza could slap Californians with an extra $830 a person per year. That's enough to buy a lifetime supply of avocados or a small island in Animal Crossing. Take your pick. But wait, there's more. California has the highest effective poverty rate in the nation. So that extra $830 a year, it's real money to the working poor. And this is in a state where power rates have already increased by 127% over the past decade. It's like handing the poor of that state a golden ticket to the avocado aisle, but the price tag is steeper than Mount Everest. Takeaway number two. Let's rewind back to August 2022, when California faced a 10-day power shutdown. Why? Because Newsom's electric vehicle rule kicked in, and suddenly charging your electric car is like trying to find a unicorn at a petting zoo. California's citizens were told, hey, refrain from charging your electric cars, while Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm seemingly was cheering from the sidelines. It's like hosting a potluck and forgetting to bring the main dish. But here's the kicker. California would be better off modernizing its archaic electrical grid instead of increasing demand on its already overtaxed infrastructure. It's like the politicians don't understand cause and effect. That's a whole new segment waiting to happen, folks, along with unraveling the mystery why some politicians wear ties even in heat waves. Takeaway number three. Two-thirds of Californians are eyeing the exit sign from the state. They're not fleeing to Mars. They're just tired of paying sky-high energy bills, inflationary policies, and high tax rates. If California were a reality TV show, it would be called Survivor, the Golden State Edition. Contestants battle rolling blackouts, solar panel subsidies, and a cameo appearance by Governor Newsom himself. Spoiler alert, the tribe has spoken, and they're packing their bags faster than a Kardashian on a shopping spree. Takeaway number four. Hold on to your charging cables because the EPA wants in on the action. Inspired by Newsom's playbook, they're mandating 70% of America's new vehicles be electric plug-in capable by the year 2032. Because nothing says freedom like limited range and anxiety-inducing charging stations. It's like the federal government can't resist topping California's poorly conceived policy ideas with an even worse approach applied carte blanche nationwide. It's a game of one-upsmanship where the winner gets a lifetime supply of renewable energy guilt. In conclusion, I will leave you with this riddle. Why did the Californian cross the road? The answer is obvious: to escape the energy bill. But seriously, Governor Newsom, focus less on your green fever dreams and more on making energy affordable for the poor and modernizing your electrical grid. Because when the lights go out, ideology won't keep you warm at night. And remember, folks, if life gives you lemons, make solar panels. Or move to Texas. Your call.
The revolution continues in 3, 2, 1. This is the Modern Federalist.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Modern Federalist podcast. In this segment, we're going to peel back the layers of academia, revealing a disturbing reality where reason has been replaced by ideological dogma. Now, let's talk about the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA. Yes, the esteemed institution that once stood for rigorous education, scientific inquiry, and intellectual freedom. But alas, my friends, those days are long gone. Instead, we find ourselves in a dystopian reality where compelled prayer and woke drivel reign supreme. So what's the latest from the hallowed halls of UCLA's medical school? Picture this in your mind's eye. You're a first-year medical student, eager to learn, and then you're forced to attend a lecture by a Hamas supporter. Yes, you heard that right, a Hamas supporter. Your instructor, Lisa Gray Garcia, who apparently goes by the nickname Tiny, stood before them and declared modern medicine is just, quote, white science, end quote, and we should all bow down to the enlightened wisdom of, well, I'm not sure who exactly. Maybe the Hamas playbook? And let's not forget the Peace de Resistance. Compelled prayer. Yes, UCLA medical students were required to participate in a lecturer-led prayer to Mama Earth and their ancestors. UCLA, there's no exception in the First Amendment for compelled prayer to a made-up deity. But wait, there's more. Previously, the medical school at UCLA stirred controversy with an exercise in its required course titled Structured Racism and Health Equity. These budding doctors were herded into racial caucuses. Their options? The White Student Caucus Group, the Non-Black People of Color, NBPOC, Student Caucus Group, and the Black Student Caucus Group. You know, nothing screams woke medicine these days quite like segregating students based on their skin color. Fortunately, I will point out, there was a civil rights complaint that put an end to this particular racially based shenanigan. But hold your horses, taxpayers. Your hard-earned dollars are funding this circus. And what do you get in return? Violations of students' constitutional rights in a medical curriculum that's more twisted than a pretzel at a yoga retreat. But folks, this is a story that keeps on giving. According to the Washington Free Beacon, UCLA Geffen medical students are now required to read an essay entitled No Health, No Care, The Big Fat Loophole in the Hippocratic Oath by one Markiel Mercedes. Now let me introduce you to Markiel, a self-proclaimed fat liberationist. She believes that obesity is not a health issue, but a slur, a weapon wielded against specific groups, Black, disabled, trans, poor, fat people. Yes, you heard that right, because nothing says scientific rigor like turning medical discourse into a social justice battleground. Now, to fully understand what Marchiel's point of view is, you have to dissect her essay. Picture this, a 13-year-old Marchiel visiting a slim, white, blonde doctor. The experience, apparently, for her was unsatisfactory, so she begins her self-centered, indulgent rant, a nonsensical ode to victimhood. She force-feeds the reader a smorgasbord of intersectionality terms, tracing the origins of fat phobia back to, well, you guessed it, white European Enlightenment philosophers. Because, you know, Jean-Jacques Rousseau was probably too busy fat-shaming dinner guests to focus on his social contract. But hold your skepticism, listeners. Marchiel claims that the relationship between weight and health is, quote, muddy. Is that so? Weight loss, in her words, is a useless, hopeless endeavor. Forget genetics. Forget underlying medical conditions. Forget individual variations. Forget Ozempic, even. Science missed the memo. Don't bother losing weight if you're obese. Brilliant, isn't it? Now let's turn to the heavyweight champion of reason, Dr. Jeffrey Flier, a former dean of the Harvard Medical School. He's not mincing words. This course at UCLA promotes, in his words, extensive and dangerous misinformation. Obesity, my friends, is a complex medical disorder with adverse consequences for all racial and ethnic groups. Teaching these ignorant ideas to medical students? Well, that's nothing less than academic malpractice. And speaking of malpractice, as a lawyer, I will make this point. If any of these future budding physicians were to fail to counsel their patients about the dangers of obesity because of this nonsensical drivel, they would be arguably committing medical malpractice. UCLA has centered this required course on a socialist Marxist ideology. Because when you're studying medicine, nothing says health equity like ideological indoctrination. As a long-standing medical educator, Dr. Flier found this course truly shocking, and so do I. So friends, the diagnosis is clear. This thinly disguised Marxist ideology is an ailment that's permeating through the UCLA Medical School. It's time to prescribe a healthy dose of critical thinking, evidence-based medicine, and a side of common sense. Because when it comes to healing, we need doctors who see beyond slogans and embrace the Hippocratic Oath, not as a loophole, but as a commitment to patient well-being.
Let freedom ring. Amplify your beliefs with the electrifying Modern Federalist Podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, in this segment, we're going to explore a topic that demands our attention, the alarming rise of radical anti-Semitism on our nation's elite campuses. Now, we've discussed this topic before, but unfortunately, the problem seems to increase day by day. So buckle up, because we're about to dissect this issue with surgical precision. Now, it wasn't that long ago when you thought of America's institutions of higher learning, you likely pondered ivy-covered walls, hallowed halls of academia, and the promise of intellectual enlightenment. But beneath the veneer of scholarly pursuit, a dark undercurrent is surging. It's not the 1960s love-in anymore. It's a battleground for ideas, and the casualties are truth and tolerance. Our elite universities, once bastions of free thought, now grapple with a disturbing trend, the demonization of Israel and the marginalization of Jewish students. From Columbia to Yale, the echoes of history reverberate. Remember the 1930s? Well, anti-Semitism is back, and it's wearing a new disguise. Because today's protests aren't fueled by opposition to a war in Southeast Asia. No, they're driven by something far more sinister, hatred. Jews are suddenly villains, and Hamas terrorists are hailed as heroes. The narrative is ancient, updated only with contemporary locations and storylines. Friends, it's straight out of the darkest chapters of our history. And what do the so-called progressives do? Many are cheering for Israel's demise, chanting slogans that call for the obliteration of an entire nation and its people, a nation that happens to be one of our strongest allies, and not to mention the beacon of democracy in an area of the world that is surrounded by autocrats and petty tyrants. And the Jewish people, spanning across millennia and continents, they have endured the cruel weight of virulent bigotry. Their history is etched with resilient survival and unwavering determination. But let's be clear, America has been a safe haven for Jews. Their contributions to our culture and our society, in the arts and science, you name it, are immeasurable. Yet now, even in New York, with its vibrant Jewish community, it's wavering as an unreliable sanctuary. To the politicians out there, Mayor Adams, Governor Hochul, talk is cheap. We need action. College presidents, take note. Courage is your job description. Zibide, Columbia's Minush Shafiq, her campus has become a squalid camp of bigotry and hatred. It's time for resignations, accountability, and a spine. University administrations and politicians of every stripe would be wise to look at the recent actions at Vanderbilt University, which we spoke about in a prior episode. The power of discipline, arrest, and expulsion are not about stifling dissent. It's about preserving sanity. Now let's address some core fundamental principles. First and foremost is the First Amendment. I firmly believe in it. The answer to bad speech is more speech, good speech. But there's no First Amendment right to encamp wherever you please, not even a penumbra of a right, to borrow a phrase. Freedom of speech doesn't mean you can pitch a tent in the middle of a lecture hall in the middle of the college green. Secondly, colleges and universities, along with government in general, can enact and enforce time, place, and manner restrictions. These restrictions on the right to protest are fair game so long as they are content neutral. This is not about stifling dissent. It's about maintaining order. Third, we should discuss spines, as in a backbone. Politicians, university administrators, governing boards, listen up. Show some backbone. When the mob threatens to drown out reason, stand firm. Your duty is to protect the rights of all students, of all citizens, of all taxpayers, of all faculty, not just the loudest ones. Fourth, there is no right to threaten harm. There simply is no First Amendment right to threaten bodily harm, do violence, disrupt classes, or disturb the rights of others. When your speech or actions infringe on another citizen's rights, your rights end. Number five, canceling classes or commencement. Recently, the University of Southern California canceled commencement, and many universities across the nation have been canceling classes, some for the rest of the quarter or the rest of the semester, some indefinitely, due to the threat of disruption and violence. Canceling commencement or classes due to the threat of disruption and violence is manifestly the wrong answer. Ensuring safety and educational participation should be the priority. Finally, the heckler's veto. We've talked about this before. You simply cannot let those who disrupt and disturb order intrude into the rights of others. This type of behavior cannot be enabled and cannot be normalized. So my friends, whether you're sipping coffee in a conservative corner or pondering life's mysteries surrounded in a liberal enclave, remember this, anti-Semitism is everyone's problem. We must be wise, we must be vigilant, and we must reclaim our universities from the abyss. Because remember, our campuses are where ideas clash, and that is great. But they should never be breeding grounds for hatred, for intolerance, and for disruption. In this next segment, I have an interview with Jamison Brogy, a Marine, an attorney, and a champion of civics education. Jamison is a United States Marine stationed at MCAS Cherry Point, and he's not your typical advocate. His unwavering commitment to education and constitutional principles has left an indelible mark in the state of South Carolina, the state of North Carolina, and beyond. For 8 years in South Carolina, Jamison worked tirelessly to achieve a transformative goal, the passage of the Reinforcing College Education on America's Constitutional Heritage Act, the REACH Act in South Carolina. This landmark legislation requires all first-year college students in that state to complete a three-credit-hour class on the United States Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, and the Emancipation Proclamation. The REACH Act ensured thousands of South Carolina college students annually receive a comprehensive understanding of America's founding principles. When he became a resident of the state of North Carolina as a private citizen, he sought to have the state of North Carolina enact similar legislation. Jamison earned his Juris Doctor degree from George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School in Arlington, Virginia. During law school, he made significant contributions as a symposium editor for the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy and as a senior articles editor for the George Mason University National Security Law Journal. His legal acumen and dedication to constitutional education set the stage for his impactful work. Now, I shouldn't have to say this, but I will anyway out of an abundance of caution. Jamison's efforts in passing the REACH Act and his views expressed on this program do not represent the United States Marine Corps or the United States Department of Defense. Without any further ado, let's welcome Jameson Brugge to the program. Jameson, welcome to the Modern Federalist Podcast.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Can you explain a little bit about the development process of the REACH bill and what inspired you to proceed with this?
Sure. I love our country. I'm so grateful to be an American. I'm so thankful for the rights that we have and the principles that our founding fathers put in place. And one thing I'm really grateful for in this country is that our founding fathers wrote those principles down. Things like belief in a creator and rule of law, things you read in the Declaration of Independence and our separation of powers established in the Constitution. So we really do have a great setup that we have a lot to be thankful for. But we're not born knowing these things. People have to learn these things. You have to be educated. And unfortunately today, we see that so many Americans know very little about our government, how it functions, and what our rights really are as Americans. We saw in one survey from the American Council of Trustees and Alumni that 10% of college graduates being judge duties on the Supreme Court. That's always a laughable one to talk about, but it always gets people's attention. But we see things like a third of Americans can't name a single right in the First Amendment. So these are the problems we have, and we see these problems at the college level. When we look at the University of North Carolina system, not a single public college of the 16 public colleges require American government to graduate. So we see the problem that college graduates know little about our country and our founding documents and our founding principles. And then we look at our UNC system and we see that no public college within the UNC system requires American government. So we see the problem and we see that they're not working to fix it. So the REACH Act, if it passes, would require that all college students to graduate in the UNC system, the community college system, we have to take a class on American government. We'll talk about a little specifics of what's in the legislation, but it requires people to take a 3-credit-hour class, a regular semester class on American government. When we put in the bill certain safeguards, and we said that, hey, if you're going to take a class on American government and American founding documents, we actually put in the legislation that students have to read those documents for themselves and they're in.
Can you give us a little insight on the legislative history of this particular bill in North Carolina?
Sure. So I was, really excited about it. And so I'm just a citizen. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not paid by any group. You have all these different groups that are, commercial or even wonderful nonprofits. I'm not paid by any group. I'm just a citizen. I live in Morehead City. I'm an attorney barred in North Carolina. My day job, I'm a United States Marine on active duty at Marine Corps Air Station Cherry Point. And that's my day job. So every time I work on this, when I've gone to Raleigh, I take a day off from work. It's a vacation day for me. But I do it because I think it's really important. As a citizen, I quite simply did the old-fashioned way. I called my state representative. I called my state senator and said, hey, this is my idea. I've drafted the language. I worked with different policy groups to help draft it, worked with different groups to see if they were supportive of it. Very like-minded people. I've contacted different people from college entities. I had one of the drafters of it one of the drafters who helped me write it is a former vice president of Coastal Carolina University in South Carolina, where we have the similar SC REACH Act. He was there for 40 years at Coastal Carolina, including as executive VP, professor, and general counsel. He also is on the commission of the State Higher Education Commission in South Carolina. A lot of input from a lot of wonderful people. Did it the old-fashioned way, called my elected leaders, and they said, absolutely. And then, of course, you need more than just a couple of two. I would just cold call legislators and ask them, hey, this is who I was. I didn't have any connections at all. Said, hey, would you be interested in this? This is the problem. Most legislators are like, wow, that is really absolutely. And the co-chairman of both the House Education Committee and the co-chairman of the Senate Education Committee, both of them, they're all signed on as sponsors. And so that was really exciting. So that's how we got it started. And we pushed off and we got it past the House of Representatives pretty quickly in the long session last year.
And it passed the House of Representatives before the crossover deadline, correct?
That's right. Yeah. So the key date to keep legislation moving is you have to beat that crossover deadline. So, listeners of your podcast are going to know we have a long session and a short session after every election in North Carolina. So the long session in 2023 met. You have that crossover date, which it has to pass over one chamber before the other chamber will consider it. We beat that timeline. We were, first on every agenda or first in every committee meeting in the House Higher Education Committee. I think we might have been on the second committee meeting of the House Community Colleges Committee, and then a couple, of course, after the Rules Committee. We moved very quickly, and we passed in March of 2023, and then it passed the House of Representatives. And again, so we're operating off this House version, but we had a Senate version as well. And that is sponsored by both chairmen of the Senate Education Committee. So the House version gets over there first, and it went to the Senate Rules Committee, and it's been sitting there since. And we know why. And we'll talk about this. The University of North Carolina has been vehemently opposed to this, unfortunately, both the professors and the administration. And they're fighting very hard, saying this wasn't needed. We had uncovered emails from, I filed different public record requests from a lobby and the administration for the university. These are taxpayer-funded lobbyists. And I was really disheartened as a citizen. One lobbyist for the University of North Carolina system called this idea red meat theater. I can tell you right now, the only thing I wanted to do is country, and I wanted people to know our founding documents. But he mocked it, called a red meat theater, called it a wrap yourself in American flag bill. I mean, service members die to protect the Constitution, and yes, they do come back and get draped in the American flag. And so I took that very offensive, and it hurt me very much, right? All those things. We had the president of the University of North Carolina system, Peter Hahn, saying an email that was all published in the Carolina Journal. I published all these emails, their public record, where he called that the legislature was off the mark. And this done in high school, college students shouldn't have to do this again. But that's odd to me, because we see that college is needed, and UNC isn't doing this on its own. They don't require a class in American government. But you see most of the public colleges in North Carolina, they do require, not electives, do require real 3-credit and 6-credit-hour courses in diversity, DEI, global understanding. For example, Chapel Hill requires a 3-credit-hour class in global understanding. Chapel Hill requires 3-credit hours in diversity, equity, inclusion. Not as electives, but requirements that all students have to take. And yet we're told, hey, American government is taught in high school. It shouldn't be done in college. That's not important. And that's where we are now, past the House, we're sitting in the Senate, and we'll see if this Senate acts on it here in the fourth session.
That is a very strong point, and it's pretty weak sauce when the university leadership is taking that position. I went to UNC Chapel Hill decades ago, so things may have changed, but English was required then. That was covered in high school. Mathematics was required then. That was covered in high school. You had your history core requirements and science core requirements. Things of that nature were all covered in high school, and yet something as manifestly fundamental as knowledge of the American governmental system is somehow, in this day and age, off limits and rote, and they do not need to cover that. That's just mind-boggling to me that leaders at the university take that position.
No, you're absolutely right. And you're right. When you go to college, it is true. You study many things you've never seen before, never engaged with. But there are other topics you are familiar with, but you now study them at a collegiate and deeper level. And certainly we would think citizens knowing about how their government functions and reading the documents in depth is something people should and need to know. But 673 Chapel Hill professors signed a petition against that. And it's very unfortunate. You just wonder, is there a goal that people want people to be ignorant on these documents? Because knowledge is power. And our founding fathers believed we had to have an educated and virtuous citizenry. You read that in George Washington's farewell address, paragraphs 25 through 29. And we need a moral citizenry. We need an educated citizenry. And so people have to know these documents. And so you just wonder, do people not want people to know that our Declaration of Independence says our rights come from God, that we're endowed by our Creator, we're certain inalienable rights? Do people not want citizens to know these things?
Yes, it really begs that question, because I cannot fathom a situation where 673 university professors would ever sign a letter opposing DEI initiatives at Carolina, nor would they sign a letter or saying that it would be inappropriate to study, say, the history of Palestine. But the fact that that many were so vocal to oppose studying American governance and the bedrock founding documents of our country, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, what our system of government really is, and also who wrote documents such as the Declaration of Independence, people like Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, that's just amazing to me. Let's take a step back, though, a bit and talk about you've encountered public opposition from individuals such as the university professors. What are some of their main arguments against the REACH bill?
So as I, you know, we just talked about, there is like a wonder of like, why are they so opposed to this? Now their stated opposition is something much more nuanced. They always say, which is fully and inappropriate for the legislature to say anything about what we do as our public. That's flawed for a number of reasons. Number one, the University of North Carolina was first created by the General Assembly in 1789. Our state constitution says all powers of state government belong to the people. And so it seems really odd to me that the university professors and administration is saying it's improper for the public to have input on a public institution that the public created in the first place. But they say, well, this threatens academic freedom, yet they can never point to any specific provisions in any academic freedom statement that somehow the legislature saying, hey, you need to study American government, our founding documents, somehow hinders academic freedom. But at the end of the day, they don't want any control from the legislature. They balk at it. They used to say it would threaten their accreditation from the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, which it doesn't. The only principle that comes relevant is 10.4 subsection C of the Act of Principles, which says that curriculum shall be developed primarily by the faculty. Well, the word primarily alone means that it's going to not complete, and it'll be supplemented by other things like boards of trustees, boards of governors, and state law. And, you know, primarily by any stretch of the means, not at play here. We're talking about a 3-credit-hour class, American government class. Now, a general bachelor's degree is 120 credit hours. The 3 credit hours of that, we're talking about 2.5% control of input by the public. And yet we're saying, University of North Carolina, you can do whatever you want with those 117 hours. You can have control over 97.5%, but they're so upset that the public will have control over 2.5% that students have to take a class on American government. And so they are just completely and utterly opposed to that. And that's what's really led up to where we're at now with the Board of Governors with the fake requirement that they're currently proposing.
That's an interesting point, because I wouldn't even concede the point that the public would have control over these 3 credit hours. The class would be taught by university faculty or visiting or adjunct faculty. So the university would be very involved in that process and in developing a syllabus and, you know, what the actual framework of the class would be. So it's really bizarre just how bent out of shape these individuals are about the public having a say about a public institution that is funded by the taxpayers of this state and is a creature of the legislature. It's almost like they want to have their ivory tower and they don't want any type of check and balance. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. And, they say if the legislature gets involved, that's just the end of the world. And it's just not true. You know, we have 50 states in the country. There are at least 8 different states that mandate by state law, by statute, that mandate that to graduate from college at a public college in those states, you get to take a 3-credit-hour class in American government or history. And every institution, and I have this all laid out in some of my materials, that every public institution in those states comply with those laws and require through the minimum medium 3-credit-hour distinct course on American government or American history. So it's being done elsewhere. And, you know, the North Carolina Reach Act, you know, it's already kind of, maybe you could argue it weak as is. For example, Texas state law requires 12 credit hours in this. Texas state law requires that to graduate from a public college in Texas, you have to take 6 credit hours in American government and Texas government and the American Constitution and the Texas Constitution, and separately 6 credit hours in American history and Texas history. So if you come in from another college or you have some sort of AP government, Texas will say, all right, well, that American government, sure, you've exempted from our American government requirement. You still have to take Texas government when you get to college. And so that's 12 credit hours that Texas requires, and every single public college in Texas follows that state law. And here in North Carolina, you have several senators and representatives that have introduced a very modest 3-credit-hour requirement in American government. And UNC has now pulling out its hair, saying the sky's falling, saying we must oppose this. This cannot happen. This will destroy the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And you've already talked about this a little bit, but can you share some insights about the behind-the-scenes opposition to the Reach Bill? In particular, you went through what every citizen in the state has the right to do. You submitted public records requests to the university. It's a public institution, and they produced some interesting documents. Can you tell our listeners some things about that?
Yeah. So again, I filed for the email from the law because it started slowing down. I was like, this doesn't seem right because everything is going well at first. And I did ask for the records, like after all written correspondence, at the senior level of the leadership of the UNC system. And that's what we found out. Some of the things we talked about a minute ago where Peter Hahn said, hey, the legislature is off the mark. This should only be done in high school. Mark Goodson, the vice president for government affairs, calling it red meat theater. These lobbyists, they are paid by the taxpayer dime. And when I work on it, I take a day off from work. These four are publicly funded taxpayers, which it's really sad too, because the UNC system is currently also violating the state law regarding how many legislative liaisons they can hire. So state law limits the number of legislative liaisons they can hire to two. The UNC system employs three. So not only are they using their lobbying power, not a good idea, but they're also doing it more so than the state law allows by hiring more each college entity separately. The state law, UNC system hires three, and each public college within the UNC system also hires its own individual lobbyists. And I have highlighted in the recent article, The American Mind, where I created a chart of the salaries of all the different lobbyists. The UNC system spends over $3.4 million annually in salaries for lobbyists. And what do we see them doing? They're lobbying against this. And they're not always even-handed, which is really bothersome. So another public records request I did with individually with UNC Chapel Hill, we saw that their lobbyist, Amy McConkie, wasn't really forthright with all members in the House of Representatives. For example, as the bill was moving through the committee in the House of Representatives, she emailed one member of one party against the legislation, the REACH Act, not liking the legislation. And she admits in her email that she shared with another UNC system lobbyist that, hey, I've only shared this with this Democratic state representative. Look, if you're a commercial lobbyist, you have a lot more freedom to do kind of things how you want to do. But if you're a publicly funded lobbyist, okay, maybe it's okay to lobby within the parameters of the law, of course, but maybe it's okay to lobby, but you really need to be forthright with members of all parties. You may even come out in opposition of what a state legislator believes, and maybe that's okay, but you really need to be forthright and say, no matter which legislator you're speaking with, this is the entity's position, this is where we stand, and you should be able to say the same exact thing to legislator A and legislator B, and whether or not you're in the presence of one or the other or both. It shouldn't be different information. And so that was really concerning. We saw in some of the public records requests, and I highlighted this also in the American Mind article, some of the legislators were not happy when that came out and actually called the chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill and that lobbyist to meet with him because he was bothered about how that was done. So those are some of the public records requests and some of the things they've revealed. I've written it in a couple of different articles, both in the Carolina Journal and the American Mind. But beyond that, we're all kind of out in the open. That was kind of things that were happening behind the scenes that were available in their public records request. But now we're out in the open, and that brings us to where we are now at the University of Board of Governors and what they're doing.
Jameson, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Hey, it was a blast. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Due to time constraints, and as I stated at the outset, Part 2 of my interview with Jameson will air in a subsequent episode. Until then, I will leave you with this. Unfortunately, in North Carolina, the REACH Act has faced formidable opposition. It's a cautionary tale that has impact for us all. Faculty petitions, behind-the-scenes lobbying, and entrenched educational establishments all push back against this legislation. The House of Representatives has passed the REACH Act, and now it awaits further action in the North Carolina Senate. Now, in the broader context, civics education is more critical than ever. In an era where misinformation and ideological polarization threaten our republic's fabric, understanding our constitutional heritage is non-negotiable. The opposition to the REACH Act raises significant concerns. If civics education faces resistance, what happens when more volatile issues such as diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, come to the fore? We must scrutinize those who wield power within our institutions of higher learning. As we await part two of this interview, let us reflect on the importance of informed citizens in the battles yet to be fought in the halls of academia and in the halls of political power.
From sea to shining sea, this is the Modern Federalist Podcast, hosted by Charlton Allen.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on this episode 12 of The Modern Federalist. It's hard to believe we're already at episode 12. I wish to extend my heartfelt gratitude to Jameson Brogy for engaging in a thought-provoking discussion about the North Carolina REACH legislation. This is a conversation that matters for all of us, and I invite you to stay tuned for part two of our enlightening exchange. Now let's address the disconcerting reality. Behind the scenes, a well-intentioned proposal encountered unexpected hostility. Instead of fostering constructive dialogue, Jameson's work was unfairly labeled as red meat theater. It's a stark reminder that some bureaucrats, well compensated, mind you, have lost sight of their purpose. They've forgotten whom they serve. But let's be clear, they work for you, they work for me, and they work for individuals like Jameson Brogy. Civics education and a deep understanding of our constitutional liberties are more critical now than ever, especially within the hallowed halls of our college campuses. Amidst voices clamoring for the demise of America, we must stand firm. The fact that such efforts face opposition is extraordinarily telling. There exists a deep state within our system of government, permeating all levels, even our institutions of higher learning. Consider what they oppose versus what they enable or allow. As the saying goes, a team is what you coach and what you allow. Here at the Modern Federalist, we remain unwavering in our commitment to truth, to liberty, and to the exceptionalism that defines this great nation. I am often reminded of the words of Patrick Henry, "The Constitution is not an instrument for the government to restrain the people. It is an instrument for the people to restrain the government." Thank you, and may liberty forever thrive in the hearts of free men and women. Until next time, I'm Charlton Allen, your host, signing off for now.
Thanks for tuning in to The Modern Federalist. Don't forget to subscribe for more thought-provoking episodes. Until next time.